From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on Thursday, June 18th. Pope Francis released his 192-page encyclical on climate and made some strong declarations about what Catholics ought to do to preserve the health of our planet. He called for a partnership between science and religion, and he chided those who have denied the science. Later this month, Pope Francis comes to the United States, and there will be events celebrating his visit here in Rochester and around the country. This hour, we want to focus on several events that aim to bring religious communities together in a strengthened approach to climate change. And so the hour begins with a simple question. Should fighting climate change be a central element of religious faith? We've got a diverse panel, and I'd like to introduce them now. Nancy Rourke is back in studio, director of the Catholic Studies program at Canisius College. Nice to have you, Nancy.
Thanks for having me again.
Neely Kelly's here. She's a member of St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Rochester and the New York State lead organizer for Mothers Out Front. That's an organization focused on organizing mothers around the issues of climate change on behalf of children. Neely, nice to have you.
Thank you so much, Evan.
Joyce Herman is here. She's part of the core team of the Pachamama Alliance. She's a member of the Commission on Christian-Jewish Relations. She's worked on Jewish-Muslim relations for years and a veteran of many of these issues. It's nice to have Joyce in studio.
Thanks, Evan. Great to be here.
Dr. Ron Wexler is here. He's a scientist by training. He chairs the local Jewish Federation Sustainability Committee and the Town of Brighton Sustainability Oversight Committee, and he's a member of the Climate Reality Project Leadership Corps, among other things. Ron, nice to have you.
Thank you very much, Evan. Good to be here.
And on the line with us from overseas, from the American University of Sharjah in the United Arab Emirates, is Joseph Lombard. He teaches in the Department of Arabic and Translation Studies at the American University of Sharjah, and he's written several articles on Islam and eco-theology, among them Walk Not Exultantly Upon the Earth, an Islamic Response to the Papal Encyclical. Joseph, nice to have you as well.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you might hear a little bit of a delay, but that should be normal, and I think that the connection sounds good. So it's great to have this diverse panel. And let me start by simply asking the panel from their various religious backgrounds themselves what they make of the discussion now of these various religions trying to come together and whether it should be an element of religious faith. Obviously, Nancy Rourke, we talked about it in June when the Pope's encyclical came out. I know it feels like it should be a matter of religious faith to you. What do you make of all this focus on that? It's not like the Pope was the first to this party, I guess.
Yeah, definitely not. And to you, I'm trying to decide if that was to me singularly or to you all Catholics, plural.
You can't speak for all Catholics.
All right, good. That's a relief. It should be essential to faith. And I think that the way that Pope Francis explained that in his encyclical makes it just obvious and clear. Because you can't really separate them. The only things that we can understand and know about the God that we devote ourselves to within Christianity is through, you know, the stuff everywhere, the world, the creation that we're a part of and that we belong to. It's our only way of acting and of living. So all of our experiences with the sacred are mediated through all of this, through everything that exists. So they can't be really separated all that much. It'll affect it.
And let me ask Neely Kelly the same question then. You're a member of St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Rochester, and it seems like this issue has become much more front and center. At least, as we said, Pope Francis is not the first to bring it up, but it feels like in the intervening 3 months or so, it's become much more pressing. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And I would say that in the Episcopal Church, our presiding bishop, Catherine Jefford Shorey, has been very outspoken about the need for Episcopalians and Christians to act on climate, not only because we are called to be stewards of God's earth, but also because of the impact, the disproportionate impact that climate change is having on the poor. Not only as we're seeing the extreme weather and the floods and the storms, but also the poor are on the front lines of the fossil fuel industry that is devastating their communities and their health. So as Christians, as a Christian, I should say, I am absolutely called to act.
Okay. Joyce Herman, from your own perspective, your own religious faith background.
My background, my faith is Jewish, and certainly as a Reform Jew, I've been appreciative of the very strong stance that the Reform movement has taken around the environment. And at this moment, given the confluence of the Pope's visit with the high holiday season, I'm particularly grateful. Because the whole high holiday season, which is celebrated by Jews who may not otherwise go to synagogue. You know, we're called. We're called for an accounting of our souls and to return to who it is God intended us to be, who we really are. So that's very, very gratifying to me. And also, I might mention that when we have, there's going to be the Interfaith Prayer Service on the 21st. And that prayer service will begin with the sound of the shofar. And that's a very, it's a clarion call. And I think the Pope's encyclical is a clarion call to pay attention. And I could say more later about paying attention being a major piece of the Jewish faith, paying attention to the oneness and to what our responsibilities are.
Okay. Ron Wexler?
Well, I have to echo a lot of what's been said, but I think I'll pick up on where Nancy started, that what Pope Francis has brought forward and dealing with climate issues, it's all integral in our lives. And in a sense, the issue has been made worse because it's been integral in so many people's lives. The response will be helped if everyone takes heart and takes a part in taking action on this issue.
Before I bring in Joseph Lombard on the phone, let me just ask, Nancy Rourke, can you mention, you heard Joyce mention the event on the 21st. For anyone who is not aware of the events coming up in our community, what are the highlights coming up later this month?
Yeah, we're going to be hosting the prayer service on the evening of Monday the 21st at 5:30. You will find us at St. Mary's Church in downtown Rochester, and that'll be an interfaith event. And then another event on Thursday the 24th, which Neely could speak to, a rally and a march. Rallying together the energy and the commitment of people of faith and people of everything on the same issue to bring attention to
at the Liberty Pole, right?
At the Liberty Pole at 4:30 on Thursday the 24th.
4:30?
4:30.
Thursday the 24th at the Liberty Pole. And again, these are both of the events you just heard about are absolutely aimed to be interfaith events. People of all backgrounds and faiths focusing on this. Joseph Lombard on the line with us. From the United Arab Emirates, you've written about this, about the Islamic response to the papal encyclical. Where would you start, Professor Lombard, with what the Islamic faith says about ecological issues, climate change, and then responding to what we've heard from Pope Francis?
Well, the Islamic revelation, the Quran, is actually very clear on this topic, and it speaks so much of the world of nature. As one scholar has said, it's as if the final revelation, as the Quran considers itself, allows the first revelation, that is creation, to speak through it. Over and over throughout the Quran, one finds that it says that everything that one sees is a sign of God. And the Quran says, wheresoever you turn, there is the face of God. It speaks of the stars, the moon, the sun, prostrating to God. And it says that everything that is on the face of the earth prays to God. Everything praises God. So when we actually, through our actions, destroy other species, which are even referred to as other communities within the Quran, we are really wiping out one of the songs in the chorus of praise that is the world of creation. And the Quran even warns that human beings will do this through their own actions. Says that they will see the corruption they have brought forth from their own hands. And we could almost see in many ways aspects of this that one could really read in the current situation as references to the possibilities of something like climate change and the environmental crisis that we now confront coming forth from our own ignorance and our vapid and materialistic ways of view of the natural world.
All right, Professor, let me just jump in real briefly here. Let me just jump in real briefly, just because if you hear the beeping, our listeners, that I hear in my ears, it just could be a response, our phone system just trying to make sure we're all on board. Professor Lombard, who you're hearing there, is calling us, and we're hearing from him from the American University at Sharjah in the UAE. So that connection being made, and we hope that we can sustain that with Professor Lombard, who has written so, I think, prolifically on the Islamic faith and understands their approach to it. But what it sounds like is there's a kind of a consensus from religious backgrounds that this matter is urgent, that it is very important, and yet, boy, there is not a consensus among everyone who walks into a church or a temple or a mosque about what to do about it. And so how do we start that conversation? Ron Wexler, that to me is the next big question. We don't have a whole lot of time on this program anymore for the question of denial of science, but there are lots of questions about what you can do, if anything. So where does that conversation start?
Well, I think for Jews, it actually starts in about a month after everything that Joyce outlined earlier, when we start to read from the beginning of the Torah. And in Genesis 2:15, it states, God took the man and placed him in the Garden of Eden to work it and guard it. And when you look at the end of that phrase, to work it and guard it, those two aspects, those two parts of why we are on earth are in balance. And one of the things, and this has come out very well in the encyclical, the issue of balance, that we have been working so hard to use the resources of the earth, and we haven't done our part to guard it. So that's a beginning of the conversation. But ultimately, I think it goes to each of us taking actions either to reduce our use of fossil fuels individually, because collectively, if we all do that, it can make a difference, as well as influencing the leaders among us, be they where we work, our political leaders, our religious leaders, all of them, because all of us together can make a difference. It's been shown on multiple subjects.
Now, you mentioned fossil fuel consumption, and Neely Kelly, you had some rough words for the fossil fuel industry just a few minutes ago, and I suspect some of our listeners might be saying, well, come on, you like to turn the lights on. We all do. And I don't think these things are mutually exclusive, but for those who hear you being really tough on the fossil fuel industry, how do you square that with sort of modern, what you might call progress or desire to continue what has been decades of what people would call progress?
Yes, thank you, Evan. That's a great question. What we have right now in our state, in our country, and around the world is a disconnect between what we know has to happen in terms of transitioning swiftly off of a global economy that runs on fossil fuels towards a renewable energy future. And because, as you mentioned, the fossil fuel industry is tied into every single facet of our life. It's our transportation, it's our food, it's what keeps our lights on. And so there's a disconnect between making that transition, knowing what we have to do, you know, now, and what our leaders, our elected leaders, are actually doing. And so what we need, as Ron said, is people coming together demanding that our leaders act. And that can, you know, concrete change around a swift transition needs to happen at the local, state, federal, and global level. I think one thing that has not yet been mentioned is that the Pope's visit in September is all on the road to Paris in December, where world leaders are coming together to decide, like, what are we going to do as a global society to transition off of fossil fuels? So it is not going to be easy. But what we need is something akin to the World War II mobilization, where we transitioned from a peacetime economy to a wartime economy in 1 year, as one concrete example of how we can do this, as tough as it may seem. And then the second is when Kennedy said, and I don't have the dates in the top of my head, but Kennedy said, we are going to put a man on the moon. He didn't have the exact pathway there, but he said, we're going to do it. And 10 years later, we did it. So we are fully capable of, through stopping infrastructure projects, many of which are going in right here in New York State, to investing in renewable energies and efficiency, we can do this.
If I could go ahead, Ron. Jump in just for a second, When you mentioned President Kennedy's speech back in the early 60s, I guess it was, one of the points he made when he first brought this out was that we don't do something like going to the moon because it's easy. He, in fact, said, we do it because it is hard, because that brings out the best in us. And it's when we do difficult things, and when we do difficult things together, that we as a society really grow.
I don't disagree with that notion, but let me pose a different way of thinking about this approach. I worked, my first job in my career was in Charleston, West Virginia. There were billboards, and there still are, on I-64 there. Coal keeps the lights on. I did an extensive amount of investigative reporting on the coal industry as this freshly minted out-of-college student who was probably pretty naive, but, you know, wanted to know how the coal industry worked down there. And I remember being at a Governor Bob Wise news conference in about 2000, 2001, and this was in May, and he said, what our economy really needs is a very hot summer so we all run our air conditioners and burn a lot of coal. And I was the only one in the entire press corps at a state capitol who slowly raised my hand and said, is that maybe the best economic strategy? You know, and even the reporters looked at me like, what is this idiot thinking? You know, of course, that's what this state needs, is we need to burn a lot of coal. And that is so endemic there that what I fear, what I'm hearing today, are people who agree and reach across boundaries and agree, but still have a hard time reaching the parts of this country that certainly don't. How do you break through to that?
So one issue I would take with the comment that coal keeps the lights on is that it's not the coal that's keeping the lights on. It's energy. We can get that energy from a lot of different places. That is the choice in front of us right now, is not if we have energy, it's where are we going to get it from.
Mm-hmm. And it's complicated, isn't it? Because when they're saying coal keeps the lights on, that's really looking at the livelihood. It's not just at those who are the owners of the energy companies, but it's the livelihood, brutal as it might be, of the workers in the coal mines who don't seem to have any other options. So when we're looking at the environmental issues, we have to look much more broadly at eco-social justice, at what is this climate justice issue, and we have to include everybody. We have to think about, we have to let everyone know and have policies that will, in fact, lift people out of the desperate situations they're in that keep them doing things that are harmful to themselves and, you know, and for all of the generations to come. So it's that sense, and I loved that in the Pope's encyclical, that he brought all those elements together of how those, in fact, he talks about the poor, and I've recently heard folks say, maybe the poor maybe separates people. How about calling the under-resourced folks? And that's really what part of the issue is. So it's very broad. And we need to look at how do we see, and people aren't used to that. It's not a soundbite, and it's not an easy political platform.
Yeah, yeah, sure. And I want to bring in Joseph Lombard in just a second, because he gets a perspective from an entirely different part of the world on energy. But real briefly, Ron Wexler, you say it's not the coal keeps the lights on, it's energy that keeps the lights on. I guarantee you, if you drive to West Virginia and you say that, they'll say, no, it's coal that keeps the lights on.
I'm not going to argue with you. But when you get down to the actual physics of what it takes to keep these lights on,
You are correct about that. It's just, yes, a matter of reaching people and creating more of a consensus.
And,
you know,
and a part of the problem has been, quite honestly, and I'll speak as a scientist, is that scientists have difficulty communicating at the level required and at in a way that connects to people. Mm. And we're getting better at that, but it still has a ways to go, which is why it's wonderful to have a group like you've assembled today, from different religious backgrounds, because we're talking in a different way about the risks and the decisions that we need to make.
And Neely, you wanted to jump in as well?
I do. I think West Virginia is a good example, I don't use that term lightly, of the climate justice issue and the fossil fuel industry. Because if you look at what the coal industry has done to that state, the environment, their people, their water, it is absolutely devastating. And there is a better, brighter future. And we must, again, as Joyce said, bring in the people of West Virginia to be part of the solution. And that's all.
Yeah. For our listeners, if this is not, again, to just malign the coal industry for no reason. I mean, a lot of people in West Virginia, a lot of people around the country would still argue for the benefits of the coal industry. But if you've never seen a slurry impoundment, I would just urge you to Google the term. I'd never seen it from the air. When I was reporting there were 136. It looks like a lake. It's not. It's a dam of waste rock along a mountain valley filled with coal slurry. And then look up a 2000 coal slurry impoundment break and the ecological disaster that happened. Probably the biggest in that region's part of the country in history. So that's part of what the panel is talking about here. Again, I just don't know how you go to West Virginia and break that through. Maybe you do it from a religious perspective. Maybe that's a big part of it. That is certainly a largely religious state. Nancy?
I think that one of the ways to break through is to notice the cycle that we have going here. It's already been mentioned, I think. Neely has covered it. Joyce has covered it. We need to offer the political will and show the support to our leaders to demonstrate that we are looking to them to take change, and we will support them as change is enacted. And on the other hand, in vulnerable parts of the United States and elsewhere where they have been reliant on the industries that are emitting the gases that are leading us into this, devastation. They need help on the federal level. The energy companies' subsidies for the use of fossil fuel emitting technologies to produce energy are something like 500 to 1 compared to the federal subsidies that are given to the exploration and implementation of alternative, quote unquote, energies. If that were to change, coal would not be the thing that would turn the lights on anymore. Yeah. In the meantime, you got to keep the communities alive and show them that they have some help, to make the change they need to be.
I know, Ron, wanted to jump back in before I go to Professor Lombard. Go ahead, Ron.
So along those lines, we're hearing about what's happening in Buffalo with a huge, huge effort to develop solar in Buffalo. Now, when you think of Buffalo, one often thinks of, Rust Belt, but
I was going to say palm trees, sunglasses.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking. So these changes can be made. So when you want to connect with the people of West Virginia, if they have other opportunities for
that's what they
making
need to
a
hear.
Livelihood.
Yeah. They feel like this takes away a livelihood, and you are right about that, Ron. They have to hear that there would be others.
That's right. That's right. That is absolutely
right. And this hour is not the West Virginia hour. It's just one example. But that's one important example of there are parts of this country that if you don't present an alternative, is going nowhere, right? I mean, that's where we are. So let me bring in Joseph Lombard again. He's on the phone with us from the United Arab Emirates, where he teaches in the Department of Arabic and Translation Studies at the American University of Sharjah in the UAE. And Joseph, what's your perspective on the question of energy usage? I mean, we've been talking about sort of domestic energy here. You're in a very different place. And if this becomes a worldwide issue, if the Islamic faith and the Jewish faith and the Christian faith, among many others, can work together on this, that's going to be a hard sell in the part of the world where you're working, isn't it?
Well, one of the very important things I think that we need to consider when we look at this internationally is that while studies show that the weight of faith arguments might be on the decline in parts of Western civilization, in much of the rest of the world, it's not. And it's actually on the rise in parts. And so there are parts of the Islamic world where if you make the argument with the religious foundations to it, you are far more likely to get broad support for that. And it's one of the dimensions that really needs to be brought out. And I think that, that one of the wonderful things about the papal encyclical was that he made a very clear case that people in all different cultures need to be able to respond to the environmental crisis in ways that are organic and arise naturally from their backgrounds. And so here in this part of the world, it would definitely need to be something where the religious impetus behind it could be an important driving force, especially because the message is so front and center in the Quran. And it's very important in this part of the world, because if you look, for example, at the largest producers of carbon footprints per capita in the world, it's Kuwait and the United Arab Emirates, and then Saudi Arabia. So this is a place where that message needs to go across quickly. It's also a place where, if it does, change can be made extremely fast and very effectively.
I want to get to our first phone caller who's been waiting to jump into the conversation. It's Frank in Rochester. Frank, go ahead.
Yes, I want to thank your guests, especially for doing the series of Moral Actions for Climate Justice. I want to ask a question with Evan. We were talking about what we should do. I think one of the things we don't do in the Rochester area is we don't talk about addressing climate change locally, adaptation. I think this is something that's missing from the discussion. We talk about mitigation. We don't talk about action. What do we have to do to the things that are happening? One of the things going on is the climate forum coming up, candidate forum, Building an Economy for a Climate Stability, Wednesday, September 16th at the Harley School, 1981 Clover Street in Rochester, by the Rochester People Climate Coalition. And we're going to be asking candidates for election, especially Monroe County executive, what they're going to be doing on climate change. And people just don't get that connection. I mean, part of the thing is, what are we going to do about beach closing because of harmful bacteria outbreaks? People don't, the media does not connect the dots, but the EPA has made it very clear that more rain, warmer water, all this leads is going to make conditions worse for these harmful algae outbreaks, and we've already had it in Four Finger Lakes and Lake Erie. It's all over the news, but no one ever mentions climate change. We just don't do it. There's a 50-fold increase in crude oil trains coming through our communities, these bomb trains that are, we have serious problems with emergency crews getting trained and evacuations being talked about. So we're talking about mitigation, but we never talk about action. What is Rochester going to do about these specific things that need to be done?
Frank,
when are we going to have that discussion?
Frank, it's a great point. And next week on this program, we will be previewing that candidates forum. So you will hear that discussion on this forum. That's not an artful dodge by the host, but Frank's right. I mean, I think too often it's a conversation on waiting for a government or somebody else to do something. Whereas the question a lot of people have, I think very thoughtfully, is, what can I do? And that's a great point. And Frank, on the question of connecting things in the media, I'll just give you one brief example. If our listeners want to Google the podcast that of my conversation with a climate scientist named Adam Sobel, S-O-B-E-L, it was an outstanding conversation. He wrote a book about whether we can connect climate change to big weather events. And the answer is sometimes yes, sometimes no, sometimes maybe. We don't want to do it every time. But so, for example, every single hurricane, you can't just point to climate change. But the weather events in Buffalo, remember last winter, we had 3 feet of snow. Well, in the past, it might have been 18 inches. And the difference between 18 inches and 36 is infrastructure loss is very, very, very serious. And we have more moisture in the atmosphere now as a result of a lot of different things. So that generally means higher rates of precipitation, et cetera. So that can be connected.
What about the situation with the harmful algae outbreaks? I mean, it's been all over local news. No, every day people can't go to the beach.
That's a good example.
And the EPA clearly says the warmer, you know, it doesn't, there isn't a direct cause between climate change and these harmful algae outbreaks, but the conditions are going to get worse because of this, because you have warmer water, you're going to have heavier rainfalls, which is baked into our pattern in this area. So it's like, why won't the media take and even mention that? Also, added to the factor of pollution, to nutrient runoff, and all these other issues that they mentioned, but they never mention climate change. Why don't they connect the dots? Why won't they even mention it?
Yeah,
the public gets to say, boy, it is affecting us, and this is one of the ways.
Yeah, Frank, I think you're so right in so many ways, and I want to thank you for the call. So again, next week we're going to have a preview of the candidate forum, and I will say about Frank's point, I think some of us, I hope most of us in the media, are trying to understand it better. I don't think we want to pronounce every event connected, But at the same time, if we don't make any sort of contextual effort, we're not doing our job. We're abrogating our duty. And I appreciate Frank bringing that point up. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, one point that Frank brought up was, so why aren't local governments doing something about adaptation? In fact, there are activities going on. I'll speak for Brighton as well as, I guess, Irondequoit, Victor, and Geneva locally, that there's a program, state program, called Climate Smart Communities. Part of that program, in fact, the thrust of the program, is to develop climate action plans, local climate action plans, what can be done within a jurisdiction. And a big part of that ultimately will be mitigation as well as adaptation. That is, what are the things unique to a specific locality that that locality can actually do now to prepare?
Now, let me go ahead and get a 45-second pause in the conversation. And when we come back, we'll go back to the phones, and we are going to get some of your comments that have been coming in online as well about what religious communities are doing about the ecological issues facing our world. Pope Francis coming to the United States later this month. And when we come back, we'll tell you once again, if you missed it, about two events coming up in the Rochester area that are sort of multi-faith and bringing people from various backgrounds together to think about climate change and what can be done. So short break, and we're coming right back and continuing the conversation next. Coming up in our second hour, The Excommunication of a Church. A new documentary by a local filmmaker takes a look at the story of Corpus Christi, which was excommunicated by the Catholic Church years ago and still thriving in Rochester. We'll talk to their ordained female pastor, Mary Rammerman, and we'll have a conversation with the filmmaker, why he chose to make this film now. That's next hour on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Rochester Area Vegan Society, presenting a 6-week course for credit in plant-based nutrition for physicians and the general public. Classes start Tuesday, October 13th in the Twig Auditorium at Rochester General Hospital. Register at rochesterveg.org.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Climate change and fighting climate change as a matter of religious faith. Our panel is talking about that from a diverse set of backgrounds this hour. Nancy Rourke is here, director of the Catholic Studies program at Canisius College. Dr. Ron Wexler is here, a scientist by training and the chair of the local Jewish Federation's Sustainability Committee and the Town of Brighton Sustainability Oversight Committee. Neely Kelly is here, a member of St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Rochester and the New York State lead organizer for Mothers Out Front. Joyce Herman is here, a member of the Commission on Christian-Jewish Relations, among other things. And on the line with us from the United Arab Emirates is Joseph Lombard, who teaches in the Department of Arabic and Translation Studies at the American University of Sharjah, and he's written several articles on Islam and eco-theology, among them a paper called Walk Not Exultantly Upon the Earth, an Islamic Response to the Papal Encyclical. Let's make sure, if you missed it, there's two events coming up. The first is on the 21st of September. And Nancy Rourke, what's coming up on the 21st?
On the 21st, there will be an interfaith prayer service at St. Mary's Church in downtown Rochester, beginning at 5:30. We will be opening this prayer service with the sounding of the shofar, and every faith that you can imagine will be participating in solidarity. In part, in solidarity with the Pope's visit to the United States, to think about, to pray about, to be repentant about, and hopeful about the future with regard to climate change.
And may I say that there's free parking right in the lot right next to Jiva and across from St. Mary's Church.
Okay, and on the 24th, Neely Kelly, what's coming up on the 24th of September?
So the 24th will be a rally and a march starting at the Liberty Pole at 4:30, and this will be one of dozens, if not hundreds, of actions around the country to stand in solidarity with the Pope as he addresses a joint session of Congress that morning. The route of the march is still being finalized, but we are going to be marching from to the county legislature's building, the Senate building, and to call on our leaders to act.
Here's an email from James, a listener of Connections. He says, I appreciate the efforts from your guests, but I rarely hear much about one critical component of climate change, population growth. It seems to me that the world's major religions have prevented a reasonable approach to reproductive health and population. Until they grapple with that, I think it's hypocritical for major religions to claim to care much about the climate. Strong words. I'll start with Nancy Rourke. What do you think?
I understand the sentiment there, and it is in many ways a valid point, but it's overlooking an important detail to the point that I feel that it's a bit of a red herring argument. The problem does not have to do with the number of people on the planet. The problem has to do with the lifestyle of the number of people on the planet. So it is definitely true that if everyone on the planet were to live the lifestyle and the amount of consumption that we demonstrate and that we, you know, embody here in the United States, for the most part, of course, the planet could not sustain it. However, there are ways to live which are better for us, more enjoyable, more spiritually attuned, which could be lived by everyone on the planet. And it's a little hypocritical to claim that, you know, I need to get, you know, 47 acres worth of space in order to live comfortably. But those people who are scrambling for a half an acre of space, we probably don't need to worry about them, you know, surviving.
Okay, but let's talk about action then. I mean, should there be laws against the space and acreage and square footage?
No, I'm not. I mean, space, not literally. I mean, space in terms of amount of resources.
Absolutely. Yeah. Somebody with a 30,000 square foot home, should there be laws against that?
Possibly, yeah. Not necessarily the acreage of a home, but the
energy,
the
output.
Idea that that a person can consume as much energy as he or she can afford is not sustainable, and that does not make any sense. It's a way of ignoring the rest of the world, and, you know, drawing lines of causality which don't make any sense.
Ron?
Yeah, along those lines, two summers ago, my wife and I did some renovations on our home. We have a fairly large home. And we have been able to significantly decrease our utility bill. So it is possible to live in a large home. I don't know if you get up to 30,000 square feet, but it is possible to do things about how you actually structure that living space where you can actually be using less energy to live.
Neely, you want to jump in?
Sure. So I think this speaks to the argument that Dr. James Hansen, who was here in April, says we need at the federal level and global level even, is a tax on carbon. So that people must pay for the energy that they use, because we are currently not paying, for what carbon is doing and will continue to do to our planet and the ecosystem. So if we were to price it accordingly, then people would not, you know, some people would still be able to afford that 30,000 square foot home, but the vast majority of people would not, and they would start to structure their lifestyles in a way that would reduce their energy consumption. So
that's a very important point, that if we are successful in moving down this path, whether it's called a carbon tax or a fee and dividend approach, as they're doing in British Columbia, and successfully, by the way, so there is certainly an existence proof. And if you look at what economists across the board, from the American Enterprise Institute through Democratic advisors to Clinton and Obama, will say that what Neely brought up, call it a carbon tax, call it fee and dividend, call it what you want, that is the best policy approach to dealing with the issue.
Neely, you want to come back here?
There is a precedent for this as well. The two, I believe it's China and the United States, if those two countries were just to agree to tax, Dr. Hansen talked about this in April, if they would just agree to price carbon accordingly, we would be able to dramatically reduce the demand. Wanted to add that.
And Joseph Lombard, how would you weigh in on the question from James, our listener, on the question of population and what religions are doing about it?
Well, I think one thing is the idea that religion has contributed to it is a little bit short-sighted. Just for example, in Bangladesh, religion has actually contributed to a large effort to get people to willfully decrease the amount of children that they were having. And the poor Bangladeshis, they're going to bear the brunt of climate change more than anyone else, with rising sea levels and the melting glaciers from the Himalayas. The whole country will be underwater before almost any other country. The other thing is that we tend not to realize the degree to which poverty drives population growth, because many people in poor countries have very large families, because there's almost a, you might say it's almost a lottery approach, that one of these kids is going to be able to support everybody, one of them is going to be able to get a good job. And so the more that you have, the more children you have, the more likely you are to have one of them who makes it. And so actually addressing poverty in many places will lead not to an increase in population, as many people fear, because they think that everybody's going to then want the middle-class lifestyle, but actually to a decrease in population, and then to a decrease in carbon output, God willing.
Now, let me just say here, Nancy Rourke is in here. I've been saying she's the director of the Catholic Studies program at Canisius College. You're not here representing the Rochester Catholic Diocese, for
that
example.
That is correct.
emphatically true. But, you know, the question of whether religious communities are behaving responsibly when it comes to reproductive health came up on this program recently when we talked about abstinence-only education. And the Catholic Diocese of Rochester essentially doubled down on it. And they said, you know, they think it can still work, even though the evidence is stacked so heavily against it, just empirically. And so are we behaving responsibly in American religious communities and world religious communities when it comes to reproductive health? Mm. Let me go around the table. And you're already shaking your head.
No, not really. I don't think responsibly accurately describes it, no. We do as religions, and for me as a Catholic woman, one of the things that I pray and hope fervently for my faith in the organization that I belong to is a greater attunement, attentiveness, in particular to women, and in particular to poor women, to what the church can and should be doing for them to help them to become who it is that God intends them to be. I think in many ways the church is trying to push women to become what it is that the church thinks they should be, and I think that God does not exactly have that in mind. We could do much, much, much better.
Okay. Joyce Herman?
Well, In the Jewish religion, that certainly the population is expanding in the Orthodox community, and there is a way in which there is infrastructure that they build themselves, so that I can't speak to exactly how what happens to the resources, but there is a caring for one another. Personally, I think that that any kind of encouragement for increasing the population, you know, policies that will allow the population to continue to increase can be challenging. But another example of why everything is connected and why this is a justice issue as well is what we know is in communities. In general, where women get educated, and in countries where women get educated, if we focus on that, the population drops when women have...
Or at least the increase slows.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Okay.
If I could add one more twist to this, both Nancy and Joyce have talked about the impact of women on this issue. When it comes to working on climate change, I can tell you when I have been in groups that have decided that they wanted to do something about it, there is certainly, I would say, a majority, if not a large majority, of people who want to take action that are women. Mm-hmm. And I think women, whether it's because of the issue that you just brought up, Evan, or climate change in general, that I think women will be an extremely important part of the solution and trying to get our leaders to take action.
Let me grab Herman in Brighton, who's been waiting to join the conversation. Go ahead, Herman.
Hi. It's obvious that in order to make positive change in a big way, we're going to have Congress on board. And unfortunately, right now, that is not the case. My Congresswoman and senators, I believe, are on board, but there are so many that are not, and unfortunately, the weight of a few phone calls or even a lot of phone calls from individuals like myself or emails can't outweigh the huge donations from the fossil fuel industry and all their lobbying. And as far as voting some of these people out of office, well, you know about the gerrymandering, and so some of them are in many of the Congress people are in very safe seats. So what is, do you have concrete suggestions how to move forward politically on this? Because without that, I really think we're going to be fighting a very tough battle, and we may not get very far.
Thank you, Herman.
I think that's one of the things that I wanted to mention earlier in terms of people are constantly asking, what can I do? And the fact is, many, many people are doing the individual action, and we need more of that. And there are resources online where you can reduce your carbon footprint and this, that, and the other. But as the caller says, we also need people banding together and demanding our leaders act. And in New York State and in this district, yes, our senators and our representatives are on board. There is change that we can make locally in our local city councils, right? When 100 phone calls will make a much bigger difference to a city council member than it will to, you know, Louise Slaughter, who is on board with climate change and action. So I would recommend finding others to organize with to bring about real local change.
And the only thing I'd add to that, if I can go back to an earlier point in our program when we were talking about West Virginia, really part of the answer came out in that discussion, which is if we show people that it's actually in their best interest to take action and to change what will enhance their lives. So it doesn't have to be coal. It can be another solar panel plant or what have you that works towards this positive change.
Well, Tim writes to the program and says, it's a lot easier to make a switch to more renewables when we are not $18 trillion in debt as a country. Any agreement, disagreement there?
It will be a lot easier to do it now than it will be later, and we have to do it either now or later.
Yeah, and the question, when we get to the bottom line, it seems as if that phrase always seems to stand in the way, or it's brought up, you know, as an argument against whether it's social justice, whether how we spend our money and how we allocate our resources. And I think many have, Rabbi Michael Lerner for decades now has called for a new bottom line of caring. Now, I mean, it may not sound practical, but as we've talked about, ultimately it is practical because so many of the practices and policies we have are costing a huge amount of money besides costing lives, quality of life. And we need to be thinking about the future generations. This is an intergenerational issue. One of the most powerful statements I've heard is a man who said, what keeps me up at night is when I have a dream that my great-grandchildren come to me and they say, when you knew, what did you do?
Neely Kelly, about 30 seconds. Go ahead.
The thing that I wanted to add in terms of Herman's question, what can we do? And it can feel so hopeless and powerless when you look at our Congress, and they are, more than half of them deny even the role of fossil fuels in climate change. Look at the anti-fracking movement in New York State. 7 years ago, people were told, there's no way you're going to ban fracking in New York State. And people started getting together in their living rooms, in their homes, in their libraries, and they started educating the population, and they started passing these local resolutions and bans and laws locally. And then we ultimately got the ban on fracking. And the fight is not over, but the people have power. We just have to realize it and come together.
All right, one more time before the hour is out. On the 21st, Nancy Rourke, September 21st, an event. What is it?
The Interfaith Prayer Service at St. Mary's Church in downtown Rochester from 5:30 to 6:30 on Monday, the 21st of September. And then on the 24th of September at 4:30, we will be gathering at Liberty Pool in downtown Rochester to rally in March.
We could have gone for probably 3 or 4 hours with this panel. And I appreciate not only the time of the panel, But the panel is from overseas, Joseph Lombard, teaching in the United Arab Emirates, and worked through some phone issues to get some really interesting perspective from him. So thanks to Joseph Lombard. Thanks to our guest in studio, Nancy Rourke from Canisius College. Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you.
Dr. Ron Wexler, who chairs the Local Jewish Federation Sustainability Committee and the Town of Brighton Sustainability Oversight Committee. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you, Evan.
And Joyce Herman as well, a number of local commissions that she's a part of, including Christian-Jewish relations, the Jewish-Muslim relations. Thank you, Joyce.
My pleasure.
And Neely Kelly, thank you so much. Mothers Out Front, among others. Thank you, Neely.
Thank you, Evan.
All right, short break, and we're going to talk about the excommunication of Corpus Christi next hour.